From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Why is this night different from all other nights? No, I haven't lost track of the date. It's a simple question. You don't have to be at a Passover Seder to ask it. So why is this night different? Because in karaoke clubs and bars around the country tonight, the playlist won't feature Bohemian Rhapsody or Livin' on a Prayer. Instead, you're likely to hear people belting out their version of Call Me Maybe. Or if they're into the classics, you might even hear someone doing Let's Stay Together.
So in love with you.
Now, not everyone can rock an Al Green song like Barack Obama, but that won't stop them from trying. Because it's Valentine's Day, and on Valentine's Day, karaoke night has a whole different vibe. We'll find out what works and what doesn't later in the show. Also for Valentine's Day, we check in with author Teddy Wayne about his new novel, The Love Song of Johnny Valentine. Actually, it has nothing to do with Valentine's Day, and very little to do with love. But it's a dark and bitterly funny look at our fascination with celebrity culture, told through the eyes of a tween pop star. And speaking of tween pop stars, the perennially youthful members of the band Yola Tengo are here with us in the Soundcheck studio. They're going to play songs from their latest album. It's their 13th full-length release called Fade, and they've chosen to spend some of their Valentine's Day with us because they love us so. Here's Before We Run, played live by Yola Tengo on Soundcheck. Due to rights issues, we're unable to podcast today's in-studio session. But you can stream the performance and interview on our website, soundcheck.org.
Yay!
Find lots more yay at soundcheck.org. The band Yola Tengo, live on Soundcheck with Before We Run. Ira Kaplan on guitar, Georgia Hubley at our piano for that song, but now making her way over to the drums. James McNew on guitar, although he'll be picking up the bass at some point, I'm sure. Ira, to you and the rest of Yola Tengo, happy Valentine's Day. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
So, I mean, it is Valentine's Day, and it looks from the set list today that you've chosen some of the love songs from the new record called Fade. Is Valentine's Day a big deal for you guys? I mean, you're a band built around a husband and wife team. You and Georgia, people look to you for kind of romantic, intimate songs and stuff. Does Valentine's Day mean anything extra, or are you more excited that it's pitchers and catchers reporting for spring training?
I would say I grew up in a household without organized religion, so the kind of informal religion in our household was no holidays. Mother's Day, Father's Day, Valentine's Day, it was all... Flag Day was kind of big, but other than that, it was not much.
Arbor Day. Yeah. Whatever happened to Arbor Day? So now that song you just played, Before We Run, I was wondering how you were going to do this live, because on the record, it has this big kind of horn section that especially comes in at the end. The way you produced this album, was that how does that happen? Were there decisions made on the fly, or did you go into the studio thinking, this album, let's have some horns and some strings?
Well, by the time we actually went to Chicago, where we recorded the record, some of those decisions had been made earlier. Before We Run, we did a pretty finished version of it in Hoboken with James recording us, including bringing... some horn players out to our space to record, and we used fake strings. Mm-hmm. So we had a pretty good idea that was something we would stick with right. when we went to Chicago.
You know, the book on Yola Tango has always been that there are these kind of two main streams of musical thought. There's these like lovely, intimate, romantic songs, and then the big electric, you know, Velvet Underground influenced freakouts and stuff. It seems like it's not so clear on this record that there are some of the intimate songs where you have that kind of fuzzed out electric guitar sort of distorting away in the background and stuff.
Yeah, well, that's nice to hear. I don't think any of us have really ever drawn that much of a distinction between those songs. I think, you know, all the noisier long ones are, I think, to us, quite melodic.
Now, it is your 13th record. Any superstitions about that?
Well, we love the 13th floor elevators, so...
The old psychedelic band from the 60s.
Yes, and I grew up on the 13th floor. So.
Really?
Yeah.
What kind of building was that actually had a 13th floor? That's usually where they put all the air conditioning and, you know, building stuff.
I think it came later that they took away the 13th floor.
Okay. And the album is called Fade. There is no song called Fade, although the word does appear in a line of It's Stupid Things that in that song.
It may actually appear in other songs. That was actually accidental. That's something we'd avoided, like, consciously over the years, not only a title song, but pulling a line from the record. And when the idea of calling the record Fade came up, we all looked at each other and said, yeah, I think that would be kind of appropriate. And we kind of lived with it for a while, and everyone kind of liked it. And then, you know, that came at a time when we weren't actually singing the songs. We had kind of finished the record.
Right,
and we're working on other things. And then got around to, like, practicing the songs. Like, oh, well, of course it's appropriate. It's, like, mentioned in, like, two or three songs. Anyway.
Okay.
Yes.
So that the title came after you had done the record then?
Yes.
So how does that work? I mean, when you go into the studio, and this time you went in with a new producer, with John McIntyre from the band Tortoise. The Chicago Post rock band. Do you kind of know what you're going to get? Or at the end of the day, at the end of the series of recording sessions, are you sometimes surprised by what you've come up with?
Yeah. Oh, I think for sure. We try not to know what we're going to get. And, you know, we really treat the songs as individual songs. And then when we're done, you know, see... Hopefully an album is inside
in there somewhere. Yeah.
I mean, I think there's certain things we know. Having the strings and horns on the one song, actually they were even on two.
A couple of songs,
But I mean, going in, we had them on a few things. And I think we sort of thought, well, I think we were looking after that for other places they might fit. I think... We treated the song Ohm kind of as the first song. Ohm had the first spot on the record until it didn't. Like, I think we knew that's where it was probably going to go.
Yeah.
I mean, there's certain things, but so much of it changes while we're doing it.
And that's Ohm, O-H-M. It's not like, you know, some kind of tantric, you know, meditative thing. It's Ohm. I mean, the line is resisting the flow is the repeated line in the song. So it's that electric sense of Ohm. And actually, to give people a chance of what the album sounds like, this is from the new record by Yola Tango, the record called Fade, and it is a bit of the song Ohm.
Sometimes the bad days, they take it with. Sometimes the good days,
is some of the opening track from the new Yola Tengo record. The album is called Fade, their 13th record. The band is here with us on Soundcheck playing some of the songs, some of the love songs from the album for Valentine's Day here in the Soundcheck studio. This next one is called Is That Enough? Yola Tengo, live on Soundcheck with Is That Enough? You'll find it on their new album called Fade, which is out now. Georgia Hubley behind our drum kit, James McNew playing the bass, Ira Kaplan the electric guitar, everybody singing in that song called Is That Enough? And everybody will be playing April 9th and 10th here in New York at The Kitchen. You guys are going to be doing a live documentary with the filmmaker Sam Green, April 9th and 10th at The Kitchen. Ira, what does that mean, a live documentary?
Well, first let me say that in honor of Valentine's Day, the name of the piece is The Love Song of R. Buckminster Fuller. it means that Sam, the filmmaker, has put together this program with film and slides and his narration and archival footage of Buckminster Fuller, and he's on stage presenting it, and instead of having a score, a canned score, we wrote one, and we'll be on stage playing it live.
And he does his narration, the arc of the narrative of the film, live.
Yeah, the four of us will be on stage at The Kitchen.
Wow. So, Georgia, are you guys Buckminster Fuller fans?
I would say yes.
Now?
Now and forever.
So is lots of images of geodesic domes and stuff like that?
Yes. But much more. I mean, as it actually comes up in the piece that Sam, who was not an expert at all about him, but was commissioned by the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art to do something. So Sam just kind of immerses himself in the Fuller archive and learns about Fuller, like the three of us. Prior to this, Fuller was just the dome guy,
right.
And then, but it's quite a story.
Okay. April 9th and 10th at The Kitchen, a live documentary, The Love Song of R. Buckminster Fuller. Speaking of live, let's hear another live performance from the band Yola Tengo. They're here on Soundcheck, and this song is called The Point of It.
Okay. Let's see. Maybe you want to count it in for me?
Sure.
Yola Tengo, live on Soundcheck. The song is called The Point of It. And again, the latest album, the 13th from Yola Tengo, is called Fade. Okay, who wants to tell me about the Draw Yola Tengo contest? What kind of contest are you people running where the third prize winner gets the album art and we don't see anything of the first or second place?
Well, we were not the judges of the contest, so we made our a friend of ours had this benefit concert birthday party in his backyard over the summer, and we participated in it. And it was all sorts of bands were there, and it was great. But among the activities to keep the kids interested, some more dubious than others, was a Draw Yola Tengo contest. So we got we were able to take home the contestants' drawings and made our own. We thought Roscoe was. I mean, they were all winners, of course.
Of course, everybody gets a medal. Everybody gets a participation ribbon. But Roscoe Finkel, third place winner in the September 2012 Draw Yola Tengo contest in Hancock Park, California, gets his drawing on the inside of the album sleeve of the new record by Yola Tengo called Fade.
And you should probably send him a copy.
You think? It's a great little drawing on a great little record from the band Yola Tengo. Guys, thank you so much for joining us. Happy Valentine's Day.
You too.
Pleasure.
This is Soundcheck. you've enjoyed our live session with Yola Tengo, there's more live music coming up tomorrow afternoon at 2 on our website.
Because I look good in leather. Don't you know I look good in leather.
Join us at 2 p.m. Eastern at soundcheck.org to watch singer-songwriter Cody Chestnut record his session for an upcoming broadcast. That's right, I said watch it, because we're doing a live video webcast of Cody Chestnut tomorrow, 2 p.m. at soundcheck.org. Up next, our special Valentine's Day edition of Soundcheck continues, though we won't be talking about flowers or candy. We'll be joined by the author of the darkly funny new novel, The Love Song of Johnny Valentine, about a tween pop star struggling with the realities of fame and the music biz. That's next.
Yes, I do look good in leather. Don't you know it, don't you?
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Jonathan Valentino was just a regular kid from St. Louis who happened to be a good singer. Then his mom uploaded a couple of videos to YouTube, and Johnny Valentine, boy pop star, was born. This might sound like a familiar tale, but it's what happens afterward that makes up the bulk of author Teddy Wayne's new novel, The Love Song of Johnny Valentine. Teddy, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks for having me. I'm going to try not to call you Johnny during this.
Please. Yeah. Now, Johnny Valentine will inevitably draw comparisons to the real-life Justin Bieber, although he's much younger. He's 11, about to turn 12.
Right. Bieber, I think, broke out when he's about 14. He may have been discovered before that, but he didn't get big till he was 14 or 15. Simon & Schuster's legal team has reminded me to say that any resemblance to persons living or dead is purely coincidental.
Purely coincidental.
Inspired by the general phenomenon of pop stardom, not a specific person per
se. Right, right. And by making him an 11-year-old, first of all, from page one, you set up this kind of weird dichotomy in the reader's mind. It's like, wait a minute, this kid's 11, but he's talking about market penetration and, you know, his use of lingo is completely fluent.
So there's this collision of voices. He's part marketing savvy ad exec almost. He's been in the industry for 2 years. He's internalized the language of the marketing people around him, of his label. His mother's his manager, so he's gotten that as well. Combined with this preteen grammar that's more innocent and, to me, the opposite of an innocent child who wants nothing from you but love, is a predatory marketer who wants to sell you something you don't really need.
Mm-hmm. So in this book, in the world of Johnny Valentine, he's a huge pop star, but there's an even bigger, I mean, there's this MJ, who he refers to constantly,
yes,
who, of course, is Michael Jackson, but there's the fictional Tyler Beats, who seems like he might be closer to Justin Bieber than our protagonist. He's made it. He's older. He's broadened his...
He's broadened his base. Tyler Beats is 17. Similar, but also not inspired by another certain former teen singer who's now made it bigger and is older.
He is not Justin Timberlake.
He's not Justin Timberlake. Tyler is this model to emulate. He's gone through the system. He's emerged, but he's actually embittered by it too. He's a little bit resentful, but he's turned into a somewhat callous businessman at 17 already. He already knows that, as he says, the talent gets used and chewed up.
Right.
The producers are the one who make the money and get out unscathed.
It's a kind of a dark novel in many ways, bleakly funny in many parts, and laugh out loud funny in one part, which is Johnny Valentine finds an edition of The New Yorker.
Uh-huh.
and it's a takeoff on the Shouts and Murmurs, the comic column there in The New Yorker. And I read somewhere that really was sort of, for you, the genesis of the book.
In October 2010, I'd been working on another book for about a year that was going nowhere, a real slog. I'd been tutoring after school kids in this program in Brooklyn. Had seen one of the girls reading Miley Cyrus's Miles to Go, which is mostly pictures, like a sentence or two per page.
I hopped up the plane at LAX with a dream in my cardigan. Welcome to the land of fame excess. Am I gonna fit in? Jumped in the cab, here I am for the first time. Look to my right and I see the heart.
must have lodged in my subconsciousness, because a week later, a friend whom I often collaborate with emailed me asking, do you have any ideas for a humor book we could work on together? I said, how about we parody these pop star autobiographies? He liked the idea. We got into it. We abandoned it a week later, but an hour after that, I thought, if I treat this seriously, this could make for an actually good novel. So the first thing we wrote for the parody when we were still doing it was sample chapters from the perspective of a Johnny Valentine-like character.
Mm-hmm.
That ended up being used in the Shouts and Murmurs column in The New Yorker. There's also various media send-ups throughout there, about a dozen or so fake media transcripts that are used.
There's a great fake review of one of Johnny Valentine's concerts in the L.A. Times, which actually, you know, he begins to take to heart and think about a bit. So he's not, despite having spent two of his 11 years within the machinery of the music business, mm-hmm. he's not completely soulless and chewed up and spat out by it.
No, I mean, he's still at that early stage at which a critic's damning review can make you feel very vulnerable, which is, you know, I'm now 33. I was 31 when my first book came out. A bad Amazon review can get you distraught. And that was partially the genesis, too, that if I were, as an adult, still feeling upset over an anonymous customer's review, how does a teenage pop star handle the massive amount of scrutiny and really nasty, cruel, snarky criticism that's out there for him?
So how much knowledge of the music business, of all of the kind of trappings of celebrity, of tween and teen stardom, were you familiar with when you set out to do this?
As much as anyone who receives this stuff osmotically, you can't really avoid hearing about Bieber or Miley Cyrus or Britney Spears. I'm an avid music fan, so because of that, I had a little more exposure, but I had to do some research. I had to read Miles to Go. I read Bieber's book, a number of others. I read also some more serious books, including some child star autobiographies and biographies. The most helpful was a critical text called The Cultural Significance of the Child Star, an academic text.
Mm. So what is the cultural distinction of the child star?
There's two interesting points, especially that Jane O'Connor is the woman's name who wrote it. Made. It's one, the child star is not really a child nor an adult. They're in this nether region, and they combine both, but they're not really both either.
Mm.
The second one is that we sacralize child performers. We make them into these angels of innocence. Johnny's nickname is the Angel of Pop. And then inevitably they fail us at some point because children can't stay innocent forever. They fall, and we punish them because we're so upset that they defied our expectations. And consequently, most child performers become, you know, rebel against this image they had previously had and hypersexualize themselves and flaunt their drug use or whatever kind of anti-authoritarian stance they're using. And so you see this in someone like Britney Spears most definitively, who, while she was often sexualized at the beginning, still had this innocent schoolgirl look and then rebelled completely a few years later.
Did it again. I made you believe we're more than just friends. Oh, baby, it might seem like a crush, but it doesn't mean that I'm serious. Cause to lose all my senses, that is just so typically me. Oh, baby.
We're speaking with Teddy Wayne. He's the author of the new book, The Love Song of Johnny Valentine, the tale of an 11-year-old pop star, the Angel of Pop, as he is called. And his big hit song is called Guys Versus Girls. And, you know, you give us the lyrics. In fact, you've actually recorded. You're a musician yourself, I guess.
That's a stretch. I'm a mediocre guitarist and a worse singer. But for fun, I recorded my own version at home. I have a really great setup with a $6 microphone that I used.
Nice.
So I did record it, but fortunately I also asked Alina Simone, the singer-songwriter and a novelist herself, to record her own version, which is far superior to mine and is
So you're saying we should hear Alina's version and not yours?
Well, I would much prefer. You'll lose all your listeners if you play mine.
Alina Simone, the Russian-born but New York-based mm-hmm. singer, songwriter. She's been on Soundcheck in the past. With her version of Teddy Wayne's real song that he wrote for this fictional character, Johnny Valentine.
Girls and guys, burgers and fries, all get ruined with a couple lies. In junior high, we're going at it, boys throwing spitballs, pulling on twirls, fussing, fighting, tearing apart. This is how it starts with guys versus girls. Guys versus girls. Why's it gotta be that way? Guys versus girls. Will you be my girl today?
Guys versus Girls is the big hit song for the 11-year-old pop star Johnny Valentine in Teddy Wayne's new novel, The Love Song of Johnny Valentine. And, you know, the first thing is, that strikes you when you see the text on the page is mm-hmm. just how inane the lyrics are, you know, girls and guys, burgers and fries and stuff. But then, you know, if you listen to Justin Bieber's songs, and especially the acoustic versions where, right. you know, all the production has been stripped away and it's just the song, a lot of his songs are, you know, basically on a par with that, aren't they?
Are you suggesting I'm not the new Cole Porter of my generation? if you look at real pop lyrics, it actually must take a special kind of genius to write them because they are often very simplistic words like or baby, you know, not even word sounds that can be used to great effect. And actually sophisticated, complex lyrics probably work against you
right.
in a lot of pop songs. They always say the hook has to be so simple that everyone can immediately identify it. Maybe the verses can get more difficult and challenging, but choruses are often just a couple of words and sounds.
Mm-hmm. So did you do a lot of listening to Bieber and Timberlake and stuff like that while you were writing this?
I did. I had to explore it more. It's not the kind of music I tend to seek out myself. I'm not in their target demo, as Johnny would say. So I was often listening and getting inspiration as far as I could.
Well, Justin Bieber's boyfriend.
His song boyfriend.
Yeah. Listen to, chilling by the fire while we're eating fondue. I mean,
swag, swag, swag on you is the first part of that couplet, too. Which, how would you know to write that? To write swag, swag, swag on you, it's not something that that's a special kind of genius, again, to do that.
Let's hear it. This is Justin Bieber with the acoustic version of Boyfriend.
If I was your boyfriend, I'd never let you go. I could take you places you ain't never been before. Baby, take a chance so you'll never ever know. I got money in my hands that I really like to blow. Yeah, on you, chilling by the fire while we eating fondue. I don't know about me, but I know about you. So say hello to falsetto in 3, 2, swear. I'd like to be everything you want. Hey girl, let me talk to you. If I was your boyfriend, I'd never let you go. I'd keep you on my arm, girl. You'd never be alone. And I could be a gentleman, anything you want. If I was your boyfriend, I'd never let you go.
Justin Bieber and the acoustic version of his song Boyfriend. We're speaking with Teddy Wayne about his new novel, The Love Song of Johnny Valentine. Johnny Valentine, an 11-year-old sort of Bieberish character. One of the things that you point out, that you make clear throughout the novel is whatever else Johnny is, and Tyler Beats, who's the exemplar that mm-hmm. he aspires to, these guys are amazingly talented.
I mean, you just heard it. That he's a pretty good singer, Bieber. I actually prefer that, I think, I like the beat of his original Boyfriend more, but his singing that is pretty superb. He's got a beautiful timbre to his voice. Bieber also plays multiple instruments. He's a real musician. He's not some kid they plucked out to fill in the gap for some new one. He's got ambition and talent, and it's nice to see that in someone who otherwise seems like he might be a brand or a product. He's got genuine artistic impulses.
Mm-hmm. And so does Johnny. By all accounts, he is a great, you know, he has a great instrument. Even the reviewer in the LA Times mm-hmm. who reviews his concert says, you know, he could be great.
He could be. He's not only a great singer, but he has real feeling and soul to him. He's 11, though, so he can't explore mm-hmm. that yet. He's restricted in so many ways. He lives in this hermetically sealed bubble, among which the restrictions on him is he can't write his own songs yet.
Now, let me ask you about the title, The Love Song of Johnny Valentine. Am I supposed to be thinking of The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock, the poem by T.S. Eliot?
It was to get high schoolers who wanted to buy that on Amazon to make a mistake and buy this book instead. No, it's the original title was going to be The Autobiography of Johnny Valentine at first, because at first it was supposed to be his autobiography. I got rid of that framing device. Then it was just Johnny Valentine, and then I was at dinner with a friend. We were discussing the book and its titles, and I came up with it impromptu. It fit. All songs are about love. That's how he's marketed. He's Valentine, of course, is the holiday of love. So, you know, maybe we'll get a few Eliot fans accidentally.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not a bad kind of connotation in a title, because, you know, you think of the T.S. Eliot poem, and it's all about regret and this kind of world weary and fear. And fear is like a big part of Johnny Valentine's life.
Right.
What is he afraid of?
Johnny's afraid of a number of things. One is the sort of garden variety performance anxiety before shows. He's always worried and concerned something bad will happen. Once he's on stage, though, he enters what he calls the Johnny zone,
mm-hmm.
and he's fine, which is, I think, similar to my limited experience with public performance as a reader. You're always nervous beforehand. Once you get up there, you're usually okay. His second bigger fear might be child predators.
Mm-hmm.
It's this running motif throughout the book. He's constantly on the lookout for people who might physically assault or abuse him. What that seems to be a stand-in for is his dim recognition that he's being preyed on by people closer to him mentally and financially. And it all takes the place of this figure of this child predator who's out there, but he's actually getting their predators much closer at hand.
And you get the feeling, although it's never explicitly stated in the book, that this is a fear that has been planted in him to distract him from what you're just saying, from the fact that there's a whole kind of machinery yeah. that's been built on his 11-year-old shoulders. As we said before, he kind of aspires to be the next Tyler Beats, the mm-hmm. guy who's a few years ahead of him.
Yeah.
But his idol is MJ, Michael Jackson. And there's one passage in the book in particular where he's thinking about Billie Jean, especially about the beginning of Billie Jean.
Billie Jean, yeah. So I actually did a fair amount of research on that song. According to my research, Jackson spent 3 weeks getting the bass lick down for the opening, which shows you how much attention to detail he had. Jackson is the pop genius of our time. He's no longer around, obviously, but the last 40 years, he's the one to have done it.
She was more like a beauty queen from a movie scene. I said, don't mind, but what do you mean? I am the one who would dance on the floor and around. She said, I am the one who would dance on the floor and around.
He's also the person who was most warped by fame, probably in history, most warped by childhood fame, certainly. And then, of course, became an adult who clung fiercely to this childhood he never had. So Johnny admires him and wants to be the next Michael Jackson without really thinking through, this guy didn't have a childhood, and then his adulthood was this perverse version of childhood.
Mm-hmm. So the book is called The Love Song of Johnny Valentine. As you said, Teddy, this is not necessarily the type of music you listen to. Just reading between the lines, I would guess more indie, going back maybe to The Clash.
The glasses that gave me away?
Glasses? It's the way several characters talk
yeah.
about, you know, smaller, less known bands. The Latchkeys, who are Johnny's opening act,
yes.
who are presented as very kind of cool and
yeah.
indie.
So, yes, his opening band, the Latchkeys, are a group of 20-something Harvard graduates who are in a band, the kind of guys who read Ulysses but then write catchy, you know, hook-heavy pop songs that are indie rock still. And they expose Johnny to, among other musicians, The Clash. understandably so, punk rock is everything that's in opposition to top 40 mainstream pop. Mm-hmm. It's against corporate structures. It's angry. It's aggressive. It's raw as opposed to this hyper-polished, refined pop music. And Johnny takes to it without, again, totally understanding why, but he emotionally connects this sort of music.
And much later in the book, at a time of crisis, says to himself, I need to hear that song again. The song being Complete Control by The Clash.
There are two epigraphs of the book. One is a Justin Bieber quote about lack of control in his life, his personal control. Then there's the Clash quote from Complete Control, which is complete control even over the song.
That's the way the book begins. For the rest of it, well, you'll just have to read it. The Love Song of Johnny Valentine is the latest from Teddy Wayne, who's been with us here in the Soundcheck studio. Teddy, great to see you. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
This is Soundcheck. When it comes to the rules of grammar, songwriters sometimes get a pass. Next week on Soundcheck, contributor Faith Saley talks about some of the most egregious examples of bad grammar in music. And we want to hear from you. Tell us about a song whose poor grammar made your inner school teacher want to scream. Let us know at soundcheck.org. Our special Valentine's Day edition of Soundcheck continues in just a moment. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. It is Valentine's Day, and since none of us here at Soundcheck get out all that much, we were wondering what a Valentine's Day edition of Karaoke Night might sound like. They're going on right now all across the country. So we thought we'd check in with Steve Jacobs. He is co-host of The Jukebox, a karaoke-inspired comedy night that takes place at Union Hall here in New York in Park Slope, Brooklyn. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. You've done a fair amount of these Valentine's Day karaoke things.
We have.
Karaoke different on Valentine's Day from any other day?
There's a lot more cheese ball to it.
What does that mean? Is it like a different playlist?
Yeah, well, the monster ballads that would usually would take a couple drinks to get out are much more frequent on Valentine's Day.
So what really kills on Valentine's Day?
You know what really kills, and it's not even like all that lovey-dovey of a song, but Pour Some Sugar on Me is a song that I don't know if people are just looking forward to pouring some sugar later that night or what, but...
So the Def Leppard classic.
Yeah, the Def Leppard classic. Those boys knew how to inspire a love for the ages.
That's a little bit of Def Leppard's Pour Some Sugar on Me, which, according to Steve Jacobs, is a karaoke favorite on Valentine's Day. Does karaoke tend to skew towards 80s hair bands no matter what night of the year it is?
Yes. It's easy to sing along to. You know all the words. You've heard it a million times. And that's what really works, I think, at karaoke.
All right. Now, on Valentine's Day, as you say, that's a favorite. But have you seen any major disasters?
Yeah. You know, that happens more often than not with rap.
With rap. Okay.
With rap. No one wants to see you rap a karaoke song. Unless you can kill it. I'll tell you a personal story of travesty from rap. I was a couple drinks in and a friend and I decided that it'd be really good to do the Snoop Dogg Dr. Dre classic Gin and Juice.
Laid back with my mind on my money.
Okay.
Which is not fun for anyone. It's not. There's a second of recognition of the song, and then like a 5.5 more minutes of why is this still happening?
Happens all the time. You gotta get yours, but fool, I gotta get mine. Everything is fine when you're listening to the DOG. I got the cultivating music that be captivating me.
So, do as I say, not as I do, is Steve Jacobs' advice.
That is, do not follow my lead on that one. I've sung a lot of karaoke in my life, and that was a couple years ago, and it still haunts me to this day.
Now, Steve, who generally goes to karaoke on a Valentine's Day? Is it singles, couples?
I think it's a good mix. I think that there are singles expecting that they can woo someone that day, or if not, at least get drunk enough that they might have a chance. And then there's, I feel like there's couples who have a shared fondness for karaoke.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also, I would say, probably mixed groups of friends where, as a group, they've decided to hell with Valentine's Day and let's go do something fun. I think that's what you'll actually find the most of.
On Valentine's Day.
On Valentine's Day, yeah.
And you know, what's on the hit parade these days? I mean, is there anything new, any recent songs that would be karaoke favorites on a night like this?
You know what I could definitely see being very popular tonight is probably that new Taylor Swift, We Are Never Ever Getting Back Together.
Yeah.
I can see that being a very popular among the embittered crowd.
Which would be quite a big crowd, I would gather.
Yeah,
on Valentine's Day night.
It might be a fairly big crowd today.
I remember when we broke up the first time, saying this is it, I've had enough. Like we hadn't seen each other in a month when you said you needed space.
Steve Jacobs is co-host of The Jukebox, which next takes place on Tuesday night at Union Hall in Park Slope, Brooklyn at 8 o'clock. And what will the theme next Tuesday be?
It will be in a Valentine's Day twist, I Love New York.
Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Happy Valentine's Day.
You too.
That's going to do it for Soundcheck. Happy Valentine's Day. Tomorrow on the show, the inaugural edition of a new, albeit occasional, series that we call That Was a Hit. Joe Levy of Billboard magazine joins us to examine the baffling success of pop hits that probably should never have been pop hits. Plus, the success of Nirvana's album Nevermind triggered a signing spree of underground artists to blockbuster major label deals. We'll hear about the bizarre post-Nirvana gold rush and a live performance from the New York singer-songwriter Alfonso Velez and his band AV tomorrow on Soundcheck. It's a production of WNYC and New York Public Radio. Our technical director is Irene Trudell. Our engineering team includes Paul Schneider and George Wellington. The show is produced by Greta Cohn and Katie Bishop. Our digital producer is Mike Katziff. Our gig alerts are produced by Alex Abnos. Our intern is Alex Kappelman. And our executive producer is Joel Meyer. I'm John Schaefer.